welcome to another edition of the Media Chwits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. Joining me from Boston is Jillian York with the EFF. Back in your old stomping grounds, huh?
Indeed. I'm back at the Berkman Center right now, just visiting Boston. I was at a conference yesterday at MIT on mobile technology, and I'm here live from Berkman.
Tell us a little bit about the Berkman Center, because we hear about a lot of the people that are there and a lot of the things that they do. What does the Berkman Center? I mean, it's obviously doing. There's a lot of research going on there. What's the kind of the point behind it?
It's a number of multidisciplinary projects, all having to do with internet and society. And so during the few years that I was here, from 2008 to 2011, we started bringing in people from the computer science school and people from, other different departments, whereas it used to be more of a law and technology research center. And so a lot of fascinating things go on here, and then a lot of fascinating Berkman people go on to really different and wonderful things.
Yeah, like you going on to kind of the EFF.
Yes, yeah, and I don't think I'm even the first person to do that from here either. We also have Jonathan Zittrain from the Berkman Center is also, or co-founder of the Berkman Center rather, is also now on EFF's board right before I started. So we do have a little bit of overlap there, but that makes sense.
And how does it fit into Harvard? I mean, if you're at Harvard, are there classes that overlap? Or do students from Harvard go to things at the center? Or how does that work?
Yeah, so there are a couple of classes taught by Berkman staff or faculty directors, but there are also some really interesting ways that students can get involved here. They've got a great summer internship program, and there's a weekly luncheon series on Tuesdays that Berkman fellows usually give talks at or special guests. It's really really a wonderful community.
Yeah, it sounds awesome.
Yeah, it was great. I do miss it. Being back here is very nostalgic.
I can imagine. It's like bringing back the old days.
Yes.
That weren't that long ago. So I'll just give a quick rundown of what we'll be talking about on this show. We've got a really interesting lineup of topics. First, we'll be talking about internet freedom and rights in the Middle East. And we'll have Mohammed El-Dashan, who's a blogger, writer, lecturer, who's based in Tunisia, who's Egyptian. We'll talk about kind of an update on what's going on in Tunisia and Egypt and in the Middle East around rights and online free speech. And then we'll talk about Pinterest, which is kind of this new social site that's become all the buzz, especially among women who like kind of sharing and posting kind of image and visual items. So that site, we'll talk about that, and we'll have Courtney Lowry Cowgill, the managing editor of PBS Media Shift, will come on and talk about her story on that subject. And then finally, we'll talk about Apple announced that it has going to, in response to a lot of stories about problems at some of its factories in China, now says that it's hired the Fair Labor Association to monitor problems in its factories. So we'll talk a little bit about what that means if Apple is really putting some teeth into its monitoring of the factories that make the iPads and the iPhones and all the gadgets that we love. So first, let's talk about free speech issues in the Middle East and what's going on there. There's been a lot happening there. I know you follow a lot of this, Jillian. We had the Arab Spring. With democracy kind of flourishing in some ways, or at least, dictatorships dropping in certain places, like in Egypt, like in Tunisia, eventually in Libya, and now in Syria, there's almost at the verge of civil war. But in the wake of what happened, in Tunisia, now there's a ruling that might come down that will basically block porn online, and might block, who knows what else when you put a filter on things online. And then in Saudi Arabia, a young 23-year-old Hamza Kashgari might be executed because of three tweets that he wrote about Prophet Muhammad. So there's a lot going on there, and there's a lot that I guess is maybe getting better to some extent, but also kind of staying the same, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I would actually add to that to say that it's actually got even worse since we planned this program just a couple of days ago. In Morocco, we just saw someone get 3 years in prison for insulting the king on YouTube. There's another guy being held in juvenile detention for the same thing. And then just this morning, just about 3 hours ago, two Syrian bloggers who had been arrested in 2011 were arrested again during a raid on the Syrian Center for Media and Freedom of Expression.
Wow.
And that's Hussein Rer and Razan Ghazawi.
Wow, that's horrible.
Absolutely.
Where is it? Just first off, I mean, we'll bring on Muhammad and have him talk about what he sees going on. Just curious, is there a place that we can kind of keep up on all these things that are going on? EFF is obviously publishing some things. Are there other sites that you can keep up with what's happening?
Yes. So EFF is covering it, and we've also partnered with Global Voices. Their Global Voices advocacy, another project called Threatened Voices, and so we're all kind of trying to triangulate to make sure we cover every case. But you've also got the Committee to Protect Journalists, and Reporters Without Borders does an excellent job on this. And
right.
Of course, you know, the traditional human rights organizations like Amnesty and Human Rights Watch as well.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, well, let's bring on Muhammad and see what he has to say. He's in the Middle East and he's in Tunisia, so he might have a really interesting viewpoint on this.
Excellent. Yeah, let's bring him on.
So Muhammad El-Dashan is a development economist based in the Middle East, a writer and lecturer. He regularly blogs for Foreign Policy Magazine and also on his personal blog, and he tweets too much. Which I guess can be dangerous now when you're in the Middle East with all the Twitter things going on Twitter. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
So, you know, tell us, you know, we were kind of going over some of the things that's happened lately, you know, after the Arab Spring. It still seems like there's a lot of problems with kind of free speech online and a lot of these kind of new regimes like in Tunisia and like in Egypt, you know, haven't really come out and been so friendly when it comes to freedom of speech and freedom of press. Is that the situation in Tunisia? You know, this whole ruling that's coming down around pornography seems like it could kind of bring in filtering again.
Well, you know, it's and I guess in a lot of those countries, a lot of Arab Spring countries, we had this very brief, massive opening to everything, really, freedom of speech, of internet, etc. And then there are people trying to go back on those gains, and that's both offline and online. But I guess it's more, you know, it's more extreme online, I guess, because it's to some extent it's outside of the public scrutiny. I'm currently in Tunisia. I'm from Egypt essentially, but I'm currently in Tunisia. And yes, you're absolutely right. There are discussions now that were brought originally was a lawsuit that was brought last year by three lawyers about blocking access to porn websites. Which used to be the case under Ben Ali, and then internet was freed in January of last year, and now there was a court ruling saying that they should block pornography, and it's you know there are two things happening here. One is, well, there's this wariness among internet active people, let's say, that we're going back on the gains when it comes to internet freedom, and that this very much is a slippery slope for a nation that suffered a lot from internet blocking. That's a major issue. But then there's also, I guess, part of the interest of this story, I guess, to me, is how much it's really not much of a story in the public, in the media here in Tunisia. It very much is in activist circles. It very much is in the you know, open government, transparency, etc. circles, but not for the general public. And that in itself is a very telling.
Well, since the internet opened up more, have there been more people using the internet? What's the situation there? I mean, is it still something more of the elite and activists that use it, or is it becoming more widespread?
You know, if I look at a couple of a couple of simple metrics. For instance, 3G is a pretty new you know, offering on the market of mobile internet here. So I guess at some levels, Tunisia is catching up with things such as, well, mobile internet technology. At the same time, it still is a country that where a lot of people were very experienced at circumvention tools. They've always had. I think I may be mistaken, but I think Tunisia has the highest number of people who are on social media, on Facebook primarily, compared to, you know, the total population in the Middle East. So you're still talking about a very, very internet literate population here. It's not an elite thing.
Mohammed, I was wondering what you would say to the criticism that I've heard from some activists, both in the Tunisian community and abroad, that Tunisians were not active enough in opposing this new ruling, or that they don't understand the broader implications beyond, of course, the blocking of pornography.
Well, there are several things, I guess. One of the first ones is that it's really hard to, especially, I guess, when you're an elected official of sorts, you can't come out of blocking up internet pornography without somebody trying to spin your word and making you sound like someone who's encouraging the use of pornography. And this is usually a bit of, you know, of a, how to say that, of a, you know, beehive that you don't want to stick your hands in if you're a politician. Activists have been trying to be vocal about this issue. To some extent, it seems to me, again, from what I'm seeing, that the issue of internet freedom and of that ruling, I mean, that ruling comes in the midst of a bigger internet freedom issue that itself comes in the midst of a bigger internet issue or internet campaigning issue, which is about open government.
What about what's going on in Saudi Arabia with Hamza Gashgari, you know, tweeting out tweets about the Prophet Muhammad, and within, you know, a day, he was kind of on the run and pulled back from Malaysia. You know, are people now paranoid when it comes to Twitter just because of that it's being used so much, and there's worries about what's going on and what you say on Twitter?
I mean, Hamza wouldn't be the first person to be prosecuted for things that they've said online.
Right.
Not just in Saudi, in Egypt, we also had cases of people being prosecuted militarily for criticism to the army for things that they blogged or things that they posted on Facebook, which is, well, by definition, less public than a blog. It's, you know, what's happening with Hamza is incredibly annoying to me, you know, as a Muslim to a large extent. I think it's embarrassing that, you know, they would have this witch hunt about a kid who's, well, you know, who is actually, I think, you know, it would be actually interesting to have a longer discussion with the guy about. I would love to see him write more about what he was writing. It was basically, his tweets were about the hypothetical conversation he was having with the Prophet Muhammad, and saying that, you know, I like this about you, I don't like how you're becoming this divine character, etc. It's actually, I think it's interesting. And, you know, many scholars, of Islam scholars, will always say that, you know, doubt is part of faith. So, sorry, that's a bit of a parenthesis, but as a Muslim, I'm incredibly irritated that you know, that this witch hunt is conducted in the name of religion, or defending religion from three tweets. That's terrible. Well, what happened to the guy? I think most people, and I also agree, don't think that, you know, serious harm will befall Hamza. I think that it's one of those populist hobby horses, I guess, that the Saudi government wants to ride every now and then, and he was an easy target. But I think he probably will be prosecuted of sorts, and he will confess that he did that, and he will apologize, and he'll probably be released. But the fact that they've decided to do that is, I don't know. I think it says more about Saudi Arabia and its government, and how desperate it is to connect with its people, even if it's on such a populist issue, than it says about internet freedom.
That's a really interesting analysis of that. I hadn't thought of that before, but that does make sense. I'm curious though. One of the concerns that I've heard is not so much that the government at this point, you know, with all of the international attention, that the government would consider, you know, taking this too far. It sounds like he will probably get off with essentially a slap on the wrist, a fine, something like that. But do you think that there's a chance of vigilantism in this case?
Yes, there definitely is a chance of vigilantism, and I really think I don't think that the guy will be living in Saudi Arabia when he's released.
Okay.
I think
yeah.
it's that extreme. Yes, it's that frightening. But the problem is that, you know, there's always been some sort of a culture of, well, para police policing. Some of it is government regulated, but sometimes it's not. in Saudi Arabia, and I really think that there could be, you know, a few hotheads would be willing to decide to punish him in their own way, and I don't think Hamza will live in Saudi Arabia anymore.
Well, thanks a lot for joining us. Really appreciate your time.
Thank
Yeah,
you so
thank you
much.
so much. This was some really, really great insight. Thank you so much.
Yeah, take care.
Thanks for having me, guys.
So next, let's change gears and talk about Pinterest, which is has been called a social site for crafty women or women who are into crafts. The site is like a bulletin board where you pin your visual interests and follow others. It's been an invite-only beta for the last couple years, but lately the traffic has exploded, and recently has hit 11 million uniques per month, growing 10 times over the last 6 months. But the problem with Pinterest is that it doesn't have any business model that you could see or that they'll even talk about. The question is, you know, will it last, or is it just, you know, another one of these kind of time wasters? Have you played around with it at all, Jillian?
I've spent a little bit of time over the past day playing around with it. Don't tell anyone in the conference that I was in, of course. But it's actually really interesting. Different from anything I've really tried before. I like the idea. I mean, it kind of reminds me of, I guess, you know, this is something that I hope that this doesn't insult any of our listeners, but this is something that I really wish I'd had as a 16-year-old girl. It's like
It's like collage, right?
Yeah, it's like creating your own fashion magazine in a way, or your own home magazine if that's what you prefer, or whatever, you know, whatever your thing is. And one thing that I found it really great for actually is sort of sourcing stuff on local information as well as like travel. So I think I might actually try using it for those things.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's the really the look of it that's so much better. I mean, every other social network is so much focused on text. I mean, there are photos and images, but it's just having that kind of visual look to it. It just makes it a more pleasant experience to be on the site when you're going to be on it for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very visually appealing. And it reminds me a bit of some of these new, you know, hipstery home magazines.
For sure. Well, let's add Courtney and see what she has to say about it.
Great.
So Courtney Lowry Cowgill is managing editor at PBS MediaShift. She's co-founder and former editor-in-chief of the now closed online magazine New West. She also co-created and ran the Rural News Network, JLab Vo New Voices project at the University of Montana's School of Journalism. And when she's not writing or editing, she's helping her husband wrangle 150 heritage turkeys, 15 acres of food, overgrown weeds, and their new daughter. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So we were just talking about Pinterest and kind of the craze around Pinterest. We both have kind of tried it out and just enjoyed it. It's really easy to get hooked on it just because it's so pretty, and it's just, you know, as Jillian was just saying, it's like she wished she had it when she was a 16-year-old girl. Because it's like, you know, it's the ultimate in collaging and kind of collecting and scrapbooking to me.
Right. No, that's exactly what it reminded me of. I read a book a while back, which was, it's sort of a cheesy book that's been out for a while. It's called Excavating Your True Self, and it's like a guided, you know, it's a guide to clipping things out and showing yourself your true self by what you clip out in these collages that you make. And that reminded me of that book a lot. It also reminded me, you know, Pinterest reminds me of what we did in junior high and high school where, you know, you were doing the same thing, sort of clipping things out, and what you put together, you know, revealed something about yourself. It's partially about self-discovery, I think, which is interesting.
And what, I mean, do you have a sense for, you know, in playing with it as much as you have? And I mean, it does seem like kind of a phenomenon that it's addictive, you use it a lot, but I mean, have you thought about ways that they can possibly make money with it? I mean, I can see kind of advertising maybe, but maybe that would ruin the experience.
Yeah, you know, I think that of course is the million-dollar question. That's, you know, the Wall Street Journal had a big piece this week, a big profile of them, and every story that's kind of popped up in the last week has asked that question: how are they going to make money? And, you know, from poking around, I think that Pinterest is poised really, really well to create a new kind of business model. I don't think advertising is the way to go. You know, there's been a lot of talk about what they're doing with affiliate marketing. It's really behind the scenes where they're offering, you know, a pay-per-click kind of thing for some affiliates. And I'm not sure quite how they do that, but it's linked to, you know, if you buy something off of a pin, then they get a cut of it from whatever retailer you purchase something from. But the founders have said in a few stories this week that the affiliate marketing thing is a small percentage of kind of what they're looking at as far as their business model goes. But I do think that it's the cleanliness of the site, and it's the simplicity and kind of the basicness of it that makes it so attractive and so addicting. And they could run into problems if they do kind of fuzzy it up with, you know, with advertising. But there's definitely a shopping element to it. You know, like I said in my piece, one of my friends, when I asked, you know, why do you use Pinterest so much? And she said, it's because I feel like shopping, but I don't have to buy anything. And it does. It feels truly like a marketing, you know, a true marketplace where you're noting, you know, products and people and design ideas, and it kind of feels like, it feels more like a space that you want to browse than, say, I don't know, you know, any online retailer. Like I was trying to explain it to my husband actually, and I was, because, you know, I like shoes.
I would admit. I understand.
And especially, you know, living out on the farm, like, this girl doesn't get a chance to shop for shoes very often. So I was saying to him that it's sort of, you know, the online retailing has been lacking what Pinterest fills. It's a, you know, I don't get a chance to kind of shop around as on the, you know, on the metro or, you know, in a mall or something, you know, like I used to. Because you're not only shopping in stores, you're shopping around at what other people are wearing. And Pinterest has been, I think it's interesting. I'm not going to browse around on Zappos, for instance, and find the perfect pair of shoes. I'm more likely to browse around, you know, with friends or on Pinterest and see a fantastic pair of shoes on someone and decide to go to Zappos, find them and purchase them. So it's sort of, I feel like there's a big shift happening now with kind of both, you know, Pinterest, it's all wrapped up into curation and retailing and kind of inspiration and self-expression and design and, you know, social. It's kind of, there's something about it that has people so excited, and that's why it's seen, you know, there's just, you know, really large growth over the last few months.
Well, I love the idea that you've got for the site, and I think, you know, that actually solves a problem for me, because I'm someone who shops when I have writer's block, so this might be my new site. But one of the things that you said in your Media Shift article actually really struck me, and I'll explain a little bit first, just that there have been all of these, you know, different companies coming out of, you know, now that I live in San Francisco, I notice it, I think, a little bit more, but there have been all of these companies coming out that kind of don't really seem to serve a purpose. And you wrote that the beauty of Pinterest is that it doesn't manufacture a need. And I loved that. And it's really true. I mean, it just allows for this, you know, sort of creativity, this whimsy, but without any sort of, it's not forcing anything on you. And I like that.
Yeah, I think that's what feels really good about it. I think that's why it's maybe more here to stay than other things. Because like I said, it takes something that we all do in our everyday life, whether we're shopping or you know, compiling recipes or looking, you know, keeping track of things to read. It's really, you know, it's Pinterest is really heavy on kind of DIY and crafting and food and design, but you can make it whatever you want to make it, and we all kind of pin throughout our day. It's really nice to have a really clean place online where we can collect all of those things, and so that's why I think it's maybe more than a fad. I think it's going to have some staying power because of that.
Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate you joining us to talk about it, Courtney.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you. So last but not least, we'll talk about Apple after some reporting about the poor conditions in its factories in China. It's come out and said that it's hired the Fair Labor Association to monitor problems in its factories. But even after saying, you know, that they hired this association, activists have kind of complained that this group is not independent enough. And, you know, the other thing is that Apple has done monitoring before, I mean, over the last few years of some of the factories, but, you know, and they've detailed all the problems that have happened, but then nothing has really happened after that, at least that we know of. So I think the question is, I mean, it's good to see, I think some people have said this is a good first step that Apple is going to have this association look into it. But, you know, the question is, will they follow up on it? What will they do after they get their monitoring reports?
Yeah, this is a rough story because, you know, a lot of the news lately about you know, technology companies has been more about their sort of free expression based human rights practices. But this is, I don't want to call it more egregious because I wouldn't want to value one right over the other. But this is pretty egregious stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there are people that were injured in these factories. There are people, there's been suicides, at least just at Foxconn. There's a lot of different factories, and so there's a lot going on in different ones. But, you know, the New York Times had this in-depth report about it. NPR ran a story about it. You know, there's a lot that's been going on, and, you know, and it was all happening, you know, on the backdrop of Apple having this huge quarter and making so much money, and then to find out, okay, well, this is, you know, they're making a lot of money, and yet, you know, how are they doing it, and who's, like, being harmed because of what they're doing?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that... This is a tough one. I mean, I'm happy to see that they've brought in the Fair Labor Association, but I mean, there was a good point. I think it was in the LA Times piece just about sort of trying to, you know, it looks like they're trying to whitewash it. And I, you know, I'm not an expert on the Fair Labor Association, but I have heard these criticisms before that, you know, because it's a business funded group, which is not inherently problematic. You know, so is the Global Network Initiative. But their track record sort of speaks for itself. I do hope that, that, you know, I mean, Apple's just such a closed company that I do hope that they'll be a bit more open in this.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's the first thing you have to give them credit for is that they're saying, you know, we're going to monitor this. We're not going to just do, I mean, they have been doing these kind of annual reports of saying, you know, here are the problems in these factories. But, you know, I think they're saying, you know, we're going to be a lot more transparent about this. You know, the Fair Labor Association will be posting what they find out. And these are factories that are used by other companies, not just Apple, because a lot of people have said, well, it's not just Apple that's using these same factories. So this might, you know, also apply to HP and Samsung and many other electronics manufacturers. So if anything does happen or come out of this, you know, it could have a wider and you know, better effect and that could, you know, help the entire industry. But, you know, it is just a first step. It is just, you know, the beginning. The question and the proof is going to be in, you know, are they going to follow up? What are they going to do? I mean, will this lead to better conditions in the factories? Will it lead to, you know, if there's a violation, will Apple actually pull out of using some of these companies? I mean, those are really the questions, is what happens next.
Right, right. Yeah, and I don't think that's clear yet. And I worry as well that Apple will not be particularly transparent about it. And so I think that's something where, you know, we're going to need to see sort of a civil society push for them to do so.
Yeah, and I think it's up to us. And I mean, there was some petitions that were done. I think they had about 250,000 signatures on one of the change.org online petitions, you know, saying, Apple, you need to, like, get your act together on this. So there's obviously been, you know, a big outcry over what's going on. And I mean, I've seen comments on social media whenever I post about this stuff, you know, where people just say, you know, this is the first time I actually feel bad about buying an iPhone or buying an iPad. You know, I'm actually, like, just, you know, considering getting something from another company just because I don't know if I can believe in Apple. I mean, those are things that really has to make Apple worry a little bit. And I think just the fact that there were that many people interested to do this petition, to sign a petition, to think about it, means that, you know, maybe people will stay on the story and follow it and make sure that Apple does something, that it's not just, okay, they've got this association monitoring and that's it, let's just forget about it. Hopefully people will actually, you know, hold their feet to the fire.
Right. And hopefully, you know, we'll see the public results of that report. But, you know, I mean, you made a good point there where there is a lot of buzz around this. But I think for me, what's troubling is that, you know, I work in the sort of civil liberties environment, you know, which has a lot of overlap with the sort of broader human rights community. But I don't see a whole lot of overlap on this issue. I don't see the same people. And this is probably true of myself as well, at least publicly. I don't see the same people who are involved in fighting for free expression also concerned about this. And that, I would say, that includes people who criticize Apple's free expression policies in the App Store. So I do hope that this becomes a more public and broader sort of concern for people.
Yeah, it's funny. It's like almost like segmented in, you know, different rights groups, you know, that it's funny the way people do get segmented that way or into their own niche. And then, you know, it's like, why can't we all kind of band together? And I mean, I guess that's the one thing you can look at the SOPA and the PIPA protests. You know, it was really a pretty broad group of people that protested. And maybe, you know, there's more things that we can kind of band together on.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, if we look at some of the history in the fair labor space, I mean, just, I remember I was a kid when this happened, but Gap and Nike are the two companies that come to mind. And I remember that outrage really well, even though I was like 12. And so I do think that, it's going to take a bit, but I think we'll probably get to a point here where, with all of this, all of these reports, where people are going to be more aware.
Definitely.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. Along with my co-host, Jillian York, I want to thank our guests, Mohamed El-Dashan, reporting from Tunisia, and Courtney Lowry Cowgill, reporting from Montana, as well as PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Be sure to tune in for all the news, polls, and events over at PBS Media Shift at pbs.org/mediashift and our sister site, Idea Lab, at pbs.org/idealab. We'll catch you next week.
Time.